Welcome to another virtual author chat at the Poison Pen Bookstore. I'm John Charles, and today the Poison Pen is delighted to have with us two terrifically talented writers, Marjorie McCown and Winnie Lee, whose new books are out this month. Winnie's book, Complicit, is out in paperback, and Marjorie's new book, Final Cut, is her debut mystery. Before we begin our chat today, I'd like to let those tuning in know that the Poison Pen does have copies of both books, and we would be happy to hold one or more for you or put them in the mail. Just give us a call or go online to the Poison Pen bookstore. And now I'd like to welcome Marjorie and Winnie.
Hi.
Hi, thank you for having us.
Thank you for both joining us at the Poison Pen virtually today. Before we begin, can I ask both of you to tell us a little bit about yourselves before you became authors? And why don't we start with you, Marjorie?
Oh, okay. Well, I spent most of my career in theater and film, actually mostly in film. I started out in theater in New York, and then I moved to California in 1990 and worked on feature films in the costume departments, both as costume designer, assistant costume designer, and key costumer for 27 years. Yeah. And so, and then I've always been interested in writing as more of an avocation and passion, but it wasn't until I retired from film that I started to devote myself to the craft of writing.
Winnie, what about you? You have a background in film also?
Yeah, I worked probably in quite different kinds of filmmaking from Marjorie on sort of like low budget independent films, feature films and shorts in London. So I'm from New Jersey originally, but I moved to Ireland and then London in my early 20s. So I started basically interning and then became the assistant to a producer for a small independent production company. And we worked on kind of sort of low, what would be considered low budget by Hollywood standards, kind of international co-productions. And then due to something that happened in my life, I myself became the victim of a quite serious crime, which then caused me to become an activist around issues of sexual violence and an author kind of addressing those issues. But I'd always wanted to be a writer. So make long story short, kind of in the wake of that assault and that trauma after I recovered, I realized I wanted to pursue a career as a novelist. And so that's what I've done. And so Complicit's my second book.
And your first book was Dark Chapter?
Yeah.
And that was actually Edgar nominated, was it not?
Nominated for an Edgar, yeah, back in 2018, yeah, so 5 years ago.
What can you tell us about your, well, it's relatively new, it's new in paperback, your book Complicit?
So it is, it was written pretty much in the wake of the Weinstein allegations. I came up with the idea, like a few months after the Weinstein allegations went public. And at the time, Dark Chapter had just come out. And my agent had asked, well, you know, what are you thinking of writing next? And it's interesting because crime and mystery is not actually a genre I ever set out to write. But I wrote Dark Chapter, and that is about a crime, specifically a rape. And so it was kind of sold as crime, and it's, you know, quite pacey in some ways, and there was an element of suspense to it. So I was like, okay, well, you know, I have this like wonderful historical thing I wanted to write, which I still want to write. And my agents had said, well, you know, you're kind of well known for writing suspense and kind of feminist suspense, and you used to work in the film industry, so maybe you could try writing about the stuff that's in the news. So I was kind of like, well, how do I write about, you know, sexual violence in a way which is interesting for me? Because I'd just written a book which was quite intense and heavy book. So I'm like, I need to be able to write about this in a way which is interesting for me. And I realized, well, if I structure it as kind of a mystery where a woman who used to work in the film industry is approached by a famous journalist years later, a decade later, asking her with questions about a producer she used to work with, then I can structure it as something that develops over the course of that interview, where she's a series of interviews where she's kind of forced to, confront things that had happened to her earlier in her career. And so by doing that, it's actually more of a book about the film industry and a workplace and a kind of culture that enables different forms of abuse to take place. And that allowed me to kind of revisit that whole crazy life I had in my 20s when I was working in film. And just the fact that on one hand, you could love an art form so much and love the movies, but then also kind of secretly hate the industry that you're working in because of all the frustrations and all the inequalities in it. So that's basically Complicit. That's what drove Complicit.
Marjorie, what about your debut mystery, Final Cut? If I understand correctly, you initially resisted writing about this business.
Yes, my literary agent told me that. She said, write what you know. You need to set your... I knew that I wanted to write a mystery because I love reading mysteries. They're my favorite form of entertainment. Reading is my favorite form of entertainment, and reading murder mysteries is my favorite form of reading. So I knew I wanted to write a mystery, and she said, you have to set it in the film industry, because we have had many conversations about it. She said, write what you know. And I wasn't sure that I wanted to, you know, I said, I want to do something. I've been doing that for 3 decades. I want to, you know, start fresh and, you know, do something, have a different world to look at. So she let me do it for one manuscript, and she took it out to market. And, you know, after we got a nice little pile of rejection letters, polite rejection letters, she said, okay, you want to sell a book? Write what you know. So I wrote Final Cut, and it's ironic because I've thought for years that a big movie set, and I worked on big movies in Hollywood. I worked on Forrest Gump and Apollo 13 and Curious Case of Benjamin Button, The Firm, Aviator, you know, a bunch of them, X-Men Days of Future Past. And so I've thought for, oh, shoot. Sorry, Kalai, I got it worked out. Thank you for calling back. I'll call you later. I'm sorry, I had that turned off, and then I called him in emergency mode. Sorry.
Oh, that's all right.
I apologize. I'm really messing up today.
She's worked on big budget films.
Yeah.
Oh, big budget films. Yeah. So I thought forever that setting a murder mystery behind the scenes of a big budget movie would be ideal because, you know, there is just you see everything happening on the one of the first films I ever worked on the first day of principal photography, the DP got electrocuted by a piece of equipment that wasn't grounded properly. It's just on and on and on. It's really amazing that more accidents don't happen. I thought that as the author, then I could frame the action in such a way that the characters in the book would have to ask, now, are these, if a string of accidents was happening, are these really accidents, or, you know, is there something going on that somebody's trying to target somebody in the crew or in the cast or sabotage the movie? So that was the genesis of Final Cut. And it is a murder mystery set behind the scenes of a big budget Hollywood movie that is plagued by a string of disasters that interrupt the shoot. And the protagonist is a key costumer named Joey Jessup, who is thrust into the role of amateur sleuth when she stumbles over the body of a murdered coworker on set and then becomes a suspect in the murder. So that was the genesis of the book.
I think at one point, Marjorie, you had said that you didn't make the immediate connection, but it came to you later, that there's a lot in common between being a costumer and writing a mystery.
Yes, I feel that there is, because costume design, as opposed to fashion design, is really all about storytelling. Fashion design is keyed to satisfying the marketplace, while costume design is about supporting a story by revealing who the characters are in this particular situation at this particular point in time, helping to create the world, the atmosphere, and, you know, a clue to who the people you're seeing on screen are through their dress. So it really is, it's more about social anthropology. It is about storytelling far more than it is about, and design, of course, but it's all, you know, rooted in storytelling.
One of the things that both of your books addresses to a degree, especially Winnie's book, is how power is used and abused in the film industry. And I guess it can be a bit confusing, or maybe those of us that don't know much about the movie business wonder why, if these things were going on, they were let go on for so long, why someone didn't speak out. And you both kind of touch upon that in your books, but can you kind of, for someone that might not know about sexual abuse and sexual exploitation and all the kind of power plays that go on in the movie business, why someone that would be in the industry might, and I guess we use your title, Winnie, be complicit in that?
Yeah, and that is why I wrote the book. And I think Marjorie's book does a perfect example, is perfect also in showing very specific examples of how, you know, a young woman, particularly a very good looking young woman, can find herself in a vulnerable position. And that's what happens in Complicit in my book as well. And I think, you know, so I wrote the book basically because in the wake of the Weinstein allegations, you know, some people had said to me, look, I don't understand, if Weinstein was doing this for decades and people knew about it, how come he was never caught, right? And so I kind of wanted to write a book that showed how power is structured in the film industry. And if you're somebody like Weinstein, or in Marjorie's book, this director, Marcus Prey, who is a cash cow, or who was associated with great commercial success, and in Weinstein's case also, I guess, critical success as well, then yeah, you kind of can do whatever you want, right? And same thing with Bill Cosby. That's why he was protected for so many years, because he was a cash cow for the network. So it kind of sets up the situation where you have like one man who's incredibly powerful and people who are making money off of him, right? You know, because, you know, somebody like Cosby, you know, he's the talent, but he has managers, he has agents, he's a lot of people who are making money off of him. And so why would they bring down somebody who is their source of income, right? And who enables them to have their own kind of power as well. So you have the person who's the abuser, and then the enabler. And then you have, on the other hand, all these young people who have dreams of working in the film industry, right? Like myself and like, you know, Marjorie, probably when you started out, and, you know, many of the characters in both of our novels who have fallen under this myth that you can go out to Hollywood and, you know, have your big break. And some people do, right? And as long as you work hard and are talented and look good and all this kind of stuff, like you might have that shining career. And in reality, a lot of people don't get that kind of career. And it's quite arbitrary as well. I mean, there's many, many super talented, good looking actors out there who just don't have that career because they never got the right break, or they didn't get noticed in the right way. And you can say that across all the different jobs in the film industry. I mean, you know, script writers and directors and costume designers as well. There's a lot of talent, and only some of that talent gets that kind of success that we dream about. So on one hand, you have young people going into the industry who are like duped and think there's this whole mythology, and then they fall prey to really powerful people, right? And if you're young and you're good looking, whether you're a woman or a man or a child, then you can get used in all sorts of different ways. So it's an industry that can exploit people's dreams, certainly exploits their willingness to work hard, because people get paid very little in some instances, and then also can exploit them sexually. And there's no accountability for the perpetrators if the perpetrators are that powerful. So that's my take on it. But then obviously, you know, a lot of it's about money as well. And I think Marjorie, your book does a good example of showing that too.
Yeah, no, I think that's very well said and very comprehensive, Winnie. I mean, you touched on all the hot buttons. I mean, the accountability piece is partially because film is a freelance industry. I mean, there's really no HR department you can go to, especially because each movie even if it's a studio production, is its own entity. It has its own production company. It's really in every way, except administratively, a separate entity from the studio, practically speaking, in terms of its day-to-day function. There's nobody from the studio on set every day. Nobody at the studio you can call and say, hey, by the way, this guy is hassling me. Yeah. And even if you could, you know, you're the disposable one, not the powerful person, as Winnie pointed out, who has all the clout and is making money for them. And when I was, you know, this, it is changing, but systemic change takes a long time. And it's just ingrained. And I think it's ingrained to a certain extent in our culture in this country, but it's certainly ingrained in the film community, in the film industry. And when I was starting out, you know, if you resisted, not resisted, but if you like
Pushed back.
Pushed back. Thank you. If you pushed back against any overtures like that, then you weren't a team player. And, you know, if you can't stand the heat, honey, get out of the kitchen. Mm-hmm. I mean, this is, you know, this is the big leagues and, you know, all that ridiculous stuff. So, it's just, it's a very complicated, layered discussion issue. And the many, many facets to it and many reasons. People, like, everybody knew about Weinstein for years. Everybody knew. Mm-hmm. But, I remember when the allegations first came out and the women who were brave enough to finally come forward, knowing that it could mean the end of their careers, it was like the film industry equivalent of the Berlin Wall coming down. I mean, nobody ever thought that was going to happen. So, yeah.
Yeah. And I guess in complicit, and the reason it's called complicit, I guess the question is, if you knew this was going on, you say nothing because your career is on the line because you want that next job. Are you complicit in this kind of thing happening? Which in some ways we are, right? And but where do you draw the line between complicity? You know, if I'm working on set as a young woman, which I think any young woman working on set has had this experience, and somebody catcalls you, like a male crew member catcalls you, and they, you know, and you don't call them out on it, are you complicit in allowing that culture to culture to continue? So it's, yeah, but then if you're in this kind of high pressure environment where you feel like you're lucky that you have this opportunity and you don't want to screw it up, and you know, if you anger the wrong people, you'll never get a job again. Yeah, of course, it creates a scenario where people feel they sort of need to be complicit in order to get their career to the next level.
Yeah, I tried to address that to a miniature extent at the end of my book. Well, a little bit throughout, but that my protagonist does question her own culpability in it. Like, she keeps silent, but she wonders, you know, is she she knows she is enabling the behavior. But and that's at the very end when the investigative reporter is trying to get her to come forward and she's still resisting. It's just like, she says, how can I judge when I have been part of the system for, you know, in her case, 15 years, but, you know, who am I to judge? And so it's just, there's no handbook for this. There's no, and maybe there's one sort of being manufactured now or being written as we go through the experience of discovering how to deal with this issue. But, you know, it's, you know, everybody's just got to figure it out for themselves, and it's not easy.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think what both of our books, I'm sorry, John, if you have questions as well, feel free.
Sorry.
I think what both of our books do quite well is actually just kind of show this sort of the camaraderie and the teamwork, but then also the competition that happens in these different film sets. Because, like, you know, Joey, she works in costume and wardrobe, and you get a great sense of the teamwork among kind of all the other colleagues who are trying to pull off the costuming of this major production.
Thank you. That's one of the, I'm sorry for interrupting. That's one of the main things I wanted to show, in addition to all this, the talk about the camaraderie between the crew. So excuse me for interrupting, but that just thrilled me that you.
No, yeah, because that's one of the joys in some ways. When it works out, that's one of the joys of working in film. But then also, if you don't work out, if it doesn't work out, if there's like spats on set and people hate each other, then that's like horrible. It's a horrible experience, right? So, and that's another weird thing about the industry, right? But then, because there's no actual HR that's regulating this in some ways. I mean, there kind of is with production, but in my case, I also wanted to address how women, do they look after each other or don't they, right? And so, you know, Sarah is the main character of Complicit. And so you hear her at 39 being interviewed by this New York Times journalist, but she's looking back to a time when she was in her early 20s and early in the mid 20s, working kind of at a lower rung of the film production ladder. And she has a female boss who in some ways mentors her, but in some ways kind of cuts her off and doesn't actually see that her younger, you know, this younger woman that she's working with can be vulnerable in different ways that she isn't, because she's older and more powerful. So And then at the same time, you know, things happen to other women that are working on this particular film production, and Sarah wonders, like, could I have helped them out more, or are we all just kind of silenced because there's this big predator who's Weinstein-esque, but also different and incredibly wealthy because he finances the film. Did I, by staying silent and not maybe helping out other women, did I do us all a big disservice? So I think I wanted to kind of address how, you know, women in the ideal world, and they were all very talented and kind of like quite headstrong women in their own ways, but they all ended up being kind of silenced and siloed in different ways. So they weren't able to kind of gang together and try to bring about the structural change we need. So I think that's the other issue. If you're working in a male-dominated industry, that women feel like they're in competition with each other, for male attention, for career opportunities, and then they don't get to form that kind of solidarity, which actually could bring about positive change.
I think you really did a brilliant job, Winnie, because I never really thought about it from this perspective, but one of the reasons that women might be hesitant to say anything is because there's such a diversity in experiences as how they are being abused or taken advantage of. And if you're an A-list actress, you have a lot more clout than like the script girl or someone like that. And all those things factor into, do I want to say something? How much credit am I going to be given?
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Yeah. And with Complicit, there's a case of a young starlet, if we can still use that term, but a young woman who is cast for the lead in this film production that happened 10 years ago, who now, when the investigation is happening, is an A-list actor. So the question is, does she have the story that she's been hiding the whole time? And obviously Sarah, the main character, had become really good friends with that, with Holly at the time, and is no longer in touch with her because she's a massive Hollywood star. So I kind of want to look at how, you know, people can go on such different career trajectories. And, you know, I remember when I was working in film, and probably the same thing with you, Marge, where you meet a young actor, like many actors, and then like a decade later, they're a like massive star, right? Or you meet a really young actor who's super talented and never hear from them again. So that kind of arbitrariness, and yet how, you know, there could very well be not much of a huge difference in their talent, but, you know, some people end up having that glittering career and others don't. And that can be a very bitter pill to swallow in a lot of ways.
One other thing that you just mentioned about a male dominated industry, and I found it interesting, Winnie, that when your first book, Dark Chapter, was being put out to be published, there was a lot of pushback from the top of publishing because men didn't think people wanted to read this kind of story, or men in publishing.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I don't know. You know, as an author, you never get to hear the conversations that happen in publishing houses when they're deciding if they're going to acquire your book or not. But I did certainly run into trouble with Dark Chapter because it's unlike Complicit, which is kind of more of a commercial read in certain ways. Dark Chapter is very upfront and very kind of, I don't pull my punches in terms of showing the impact of sexual violence on an individual. So, but then, you know, there was a reason I did that, you know, and for me, it was important to do justice to the survivor's experience while also trying to, you know, bring to life a perpetrator in a three-dimensional way. So yeah, I mean, it's not certainly as feel good a novel as other ones, right? But yeah, I ran into a number of different scenarios where, you know, publishers thought it was going to be great, and then they were worried about being sued by my real life perpetrator for libel, even though I'm writing this as fiction, right? So then I lost a book deal off the back of that. So it's kind of, I kept on running into all these different scenarios where people are like, oh, it's really powerful writing, but you know, we don't think it's commercial enough. And this was pre-Me Too, obviously. So that was in 2017. And then, it ends up being published in June of 2017. And by autumn of 2017, the Weinstein allegations had gone public. So I think hopefully it's changed now, but yeah, I certainly ran into problems just finding a book deal in the first place for my first book.
Marjorie, one of the things I love about mysteries is learning something new, and you taught me a lot about the costume aspect and fashion aspect of movie making. I had no idea it was so
expensive,
multi-layered. I mean, I thought it was just one person designed the clothing and that was it. You threw them on the actors, but there's like all these different people doing different jobs, and there's people that do continuity in the films. And can you talk a little bit about that world? Because it's fascinating.
Well, it really is. There's a quote I use from Orson Welles at the beginning of the book that a writer needs a pen, an artist needs a brush, but a filmmaker needs an army. And it is. It's hundreds of people in a big movie company doing many jobs that are all essential to the final product. It's when you think of the volume of what goes into a big movie, like for example, on Forrest Gump, we had over 100 speaking roles, and some of them, like Tom Hanks, had 80 costume changes just for him. And we had over 10,000 background over the course of the film that we had to dress head to toe, had the opportunity to dress head to toe because it was a period film. So no one person can accomplish that volume of work. It's just not humanly possible. So you really need a great team around you. You know, you really do. And an experienced and accomplished team to work at that level. And then, yes, there are all kinds of jobs on the set, props, constructing the sets, the grips who, you know, help set up the lighting, the electricians, the lighting technicians, the camera crew. It's a whole panoply of jobs. It's a very rich, busy, it can be an overwhelming environment. Anytime you step onto the set of a big movie, if you haven't ever been on one before, it just seems like a confusing jumble of equipment and people and scenery and you don't know what everybody's doing, but everybody's busy doing something. So it's a very stimulating environment. And, people talk about how you have to stand around and wait for stuff, but there's always something, even while you're waiting, people like the set costumers have to stay there and be focused, but there's always something to be done for whatever's coming up. So I don't know that I answered any of your question. Feel free to step in and rein me in and redirect.
No, you did. You really created that world. Little details, like there's actually companies that manufacture specific cloth for costumes and things like that. That's a real thing. I mean, I shouldn't be surprised, but.
Yeah, when we were doing the Alamo, the designer wanted to make the Mexican army out of cotton moleskin. Yeah. Bright red cotton moleskin. And there was no place that we could purchase it. You can't even purchase moleskin in this country. So I had to go to a company in the UK to actually weave it for us and then custom dye it. So yeah. And then there are artisans that will recreate vintage fabrics in less quantity. But yeah, there are all kinds of vendors that are geared specifically to sometimes they'll bleed over into the fashion industry too, but are geared specifically to serving the movie industry in that way.
And so Marjorie, in your book, you provide like really interesting details about these kinds of vendors, and where you name, like, you know, this person is well known for, you know, making these kinds of capes, or this person's well known for like this specific kind of.
Oh, right.
Are those real people, or are they based on real vendors that you know? In terms of, no, I was just trying to figure out like how much of this is, obviously the world is real, but in terms of those actual specific characters, are they based on people you know?
You may have lost Marjorie.
Yeah, maybe. Are you there?
Excuse me, I'm really sorry. I've got a.
I'll give you a question while Marjorie's acclimating herself. Winnie, your book is about a very serious.
My apologies. I couldn't hear what you said.
Okay, I think maybe.
That's the joy of.
You come back to me.
You're back?
Yes. Are you guys? I'm. I just.
Don't.
worst.
It makes for entertaining television, as they say.
Oh my God, no, no, no. I'm really sorry. You'll never have me back. And I don't blame.
Are you back in the conversation?
Yes. Yeah. Everybody in the book, including Marcus Prey, is based on somebody real. And the people at Hammer and Tongs, it's a company called Ironhead in the Valley.
Okay.
And they're geniuses.
Yeah.
And they do all the superhero movies and they do all that sculpting.
Okay.
Bodies and, you know, the armor, and they're magnificent. They're a magnificent vendor. And yeah, the woman who did the capes is based on a real vendor in Hollywood. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's all, wow. I mean, okay. I didn't make up anything. I didn't have to.
Right, okay. So if somebody worked in Hollywood in the costume world, they reading your novel, they'd be like, okay, this is a thinly veiled, they would know right away who the specific vendor was.
Yeah, after my book launch, which was well attended mostly by my colleagues, in fact, he said, well, we can't get a union quorum at a meeting, but I think we got one here. and after the next day after the launch, a friend of mine who had worked on a particular movie that I was talking about that was so awful, one of the few that was awful. Most of the movies I've really enjoyed, but there have been a couple of really, you know, dragging yourself through the trenches, but she wrote on Facebook, it's all true. Everything she said is true. Yeah, so, and then in a more lighthearted way, another of my colleagues wrote, oh, it was so great to hear the shout outs to our costume family community, because there's some real people that I mention, of course.
Yeah,
no, that's lovely. In a completely positive way, obviously.
Yeah, no, that's what I found really interesting in your book.
Oh, thanks. Yeah. Thanks.
I do have another question for Winnie, because if I understand correctly, you did some work in screenwriting before novel writing.
So I worked in the film industry as a script editor, well, development executive / script editor / producer. Producers can do a whole bunch of things, but what I specifically liked working on was working with writers on their scripts. So it's a little bit like Sarah in the novel. So Sarah teaches screenwriting to students. And in her previous career in film, she also was a script editor, development exec, associate producer, but she's never written a script before herself. So that's quite similar to what I did in film. So I never actually wrote a script myself. But now I'm adapting Dark Chapter into a screenplay. So now I'm writing a script and I'm working with the script editor and the producer. So it's kind of come sort of full circle in some ways, because, you know, I ultimately left the film industry because of my rape, which didn't take place in the context of film, but it, you know, it's a traumatizing incident, and the PTSD doesn't really make you capable of working as a producer. So I left that industry. It was too difficult to kind of network my way back in after what had happened. So I was quite bitter about having left film, and I really at the same time missed the buzz of working in film, but then also missed being able to be that close to movies and to filmmaking. So anyway, Dark Chapter got optioned by a producer, and I've been working on that screenplay for a while now. And it's been great in some ways, because I'm actually like writing that script that in some ways maybe I always wanted to write. So, but yeah, there's a big difference between writing scripts and writing novels. So I'm learning a lot as well.
Oh, congratulations. That's really exciting.
Thanks.
Are there any skills that transfer over from screenwriting to novel writing?
Yeah, for sure. And again, it depends on what kind of novel you're writing. But, you know, if you're writing something that's genre or genre adjacent, as people sometimes say, so if you're writing a mystery, you know, oftentimes, you know, films like mystery films or thrillers are a very good template in terms of what readers are expecting when they read mysteries in novel form, right? So the different acts, and I talk about first act, second act, third act, like even in Complicit, which is a bit of kind of like meta fun stuff for me to delve into. But yeah, I mean, it's when you're writing a crime novel, obviously you do have specific acts that you want to have the action flow ebb and flow according to that. So yeah, that helps. So the kind of plot structure for movies, for feature film, is very much what somebody might use for a novel. But then also, I think what I've learned more is just having to be like really economical about what I put on the page. So with a script, you have to be completely economical because it's like 110, 100, max 120 pages, most of which is white space. So every single line that a character says has to be, as people say, doing the heavy lifting and saying a lot about that character, about the tensions between the two characters. And so a single line of dialogue has to be able to say a lot, even though it might just be like five words, right? You know, and then also visuals, because you may not be able to convey a character's backstory in words, but if you can, you know, that classic shot, if you're in a character's apartment, like the camera pans over and you see like all the framed photos of them and their loved ones, then like you get the character's backstory that way. So how do you tell story through visuals? Because you can't use that many words in film. So that's one thing. And then the other thing, more from a writing practice, is just, it's interesting adapting my own novel, because with Dark Chapter, I feel like I've already written the novel, right? So that's like my full statement on that story. That's my full version of that story. So if people want to hire me to adapt it into screenplay, great. But I'm not as precious about what I do for the screenplay, because I'm like, people can just read the novel, because that's my full thing as an artist. So the script editor and the producer might come back with notes and say, okay, we don't like this. Do you want to change this? Or do you want to try this? And I'll be like, okay, I mean, I'll try it. Like, I'll write the scene that way if you want, and we'll see if it works or not. And if it doesn't, we'll just throw it out. So this kind of approach of being less precious about the material has now kind of bled over into my novel writing, because, you know, I'm working on my third novel, and there's a lot of stuff I've written. I wrote like 30,000 words and I threw it out because I'm like, it's not working, you know? So this notion of like, you write stuff and then you throw it out, and that's fine. That's part of the creative process. I've become kind of more accustomed to, whereas in the beginning, I might just be like, I've written it and like, I, you know, this is my baby. And you're like, well, you know, part of the creative process is writing stuff that's going to get thrown out.
Hmm. That's fascinating. Both of you have written about Hollywood and the movie business and how it can be both glamorous and seductive and dark and scary. Can you talk a little bit about why we're so fascinated with Hollywood and the movies? What is it about it that casts the spell?
Do you want to take that, Winnie, or you want me to start?
You can start, just because I've just been speaking. I'll follow up.
I think it's that's because that's how Hollywood has marketed itself. It's all about the image. It's all about you know, seducing people, selling people the dream, because that's what makes them, you know, it's much different than it used to be in the golden age of Hollywood, when the studios really ran the show and they could really curate the images of the stars of those studios. That now it's sort of a little more free for all, but you do have press agents and publicists who can, you know, try and keep things in a lane for the big stars. But it's all about selling the dream. It's a business, first and foremost, and everything, the bottom line is, it is a creative undertaking, but the bottom line is money. And I mean, the Academy Awards, you know, everything that the film industry does to publicize itself is geared toward getting those people, well, not anymore to buy tickets, so much to go to the theater. And that's another thing. I mean, everybody's trying to figure out what it is post-pandemic and
with the writers,
the streaming services now. It's a transitional time in the industry, but it's always about selling. It's always about, and it's always about selling the dream.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it's spectacle. I mean, and from the very beginning of the film industry, it was always about spectacle, about being able to transport audiences to amazing new worlds, right? And so I think that's
and what's wrong with that? I mean, that's the business model, right? That's what we want. Everybody, it's a human instinct. We all want to be told a story.
Yeah.
So that's what the industry is based on.
Yeah. I mean, the danger obviously is that's the glamour, that's the spectacle, right, which draws us in. But then the process of making those movies is incredibly fraught with injustice and inequality and trauma and in different criminal deeds, it's one thing if a murder takes place, and obviously, that happens in Marjorie's book and people have died on film sets, as we know, and they continue to. But then there's other forms of crime, which maybe aren't legal crime. I mean, some of them are rapes, and that's obviously a legal crime, but, to be taking somebody else's credit, to be taking someone else's artistic ideas and to get their credit, or to be working a 20-something and thinking that 20-something, tricking that 20-something into thinking that they're going to have an amazing career where they're just being used for different purposes to do grunt work, right? I mean, where you draw the line between what is acceptable behavior and what's not, but we're all drawn into it just because of the, not specifically just the glamour, but the spectacle of it. So even, I know how ridiculous the industry is, but I still watch the Oscars, right? I still will watch the red carpet to see what people are wearing. So even the most cynical people are still drawn into kind of the myth that Hollywood makes of itself about itself. So I think that's the danger. But then also, and so I guess for me, I was trying to write about that because I love movies, right? Even though I know how fraught the filmmaking process is and how much can be improved. I'll still go to pay my ticket to buy an unnecessary Disney remake, live action remake, which I just did. But, I enjoyed it for whatever reason, So it is the spectacle. Yeah.
Yeah. And, it's just like any industry. In lots of ways, the film industry is all that on steroids. But, there is no way to learn the industry. You can't learn it in film school. The only way to know the industry is to get in there and work. And some of those 20-somethings who are being, taken advantage of to a certain extent, but they are learning how to do it from the ground up. And I think that's the best way to learn how to do it. The danger is I think mentoring is one of the most important aspects of the community piece of the film industry, because that's how you teach the young people coming up, is by showing them how to do it, by taking them under your wing and showing them how to work and, giving them the benefit of whatever your experience is, with the caveat that it's your experience and no one else's. But there's no other way to learn it but by doing. So there's a certain amount of that just has to take place. And in the film community, it isn't always, it isn't always sweetness and light, but I think we do have a real, and we're actually trying to get it built into the Costume Design Guild as a real thing, this mentoring program, which I think is, a really important piece that it exists in the industry, but there needs to be more emphasis on that.
Yeah. Yeah. And I certainly think in certain aspects or certain areas of crew in film production that can happen, like in costume and in camera, where you do need a team. But if it's something like actors, especially female actors, how often do you see them mentoring each other? Because if anything, there's a jealousy that there's so few parts and the roles are going to get taken up by the new upcomer, the new person who's up and coming, which is of course all about Eve, right? I think it depends on the area of the film industry that you're working in.
Very fair comment. Yeah. And you're right. And actresses, have the, are among the most vulnerable because they are, especially when they're starting out, they just, they're so vulnerable to so many influences and to predation that, if you're a member of the herd to a certain extent, like a crew, you can have some amount of community protection around you. But those young actresses, and they, actresses, if, as we all know, they just don't have the same longevity in terms of their professional viability as the men. And so that's a real pressure on them. And it's a real pressure on them too.
Yeah, definitely.
So they don't make it by, they don't make it by their early 30s.
Yeah.
They're not going to have a long career. unless they can make a transition, very few of them make a transition to character acting, but in terms of having a real like headliner career.
Just
a very short window, almost like athletes.
It's obvious from reading both of your books that you love movies. It comes through in your writing. If someone was to go to your homes, what movies would they find on your shelves that you go back to again and again to capture that magic? Do you have certain films that do that for you as an individual?
Wow, God, such a difficult question to answer because there's so many good ones. I mean, with Complicit, I sprinkle in a whole bunch of different movies there, right? I have this kind of motif of The Wizard of Oz running through Complicit. I don't know how many people pick up on that. And for me, and I think for a lot of people, like, you know, Wizard of Oz is that amazing film that literally transports you to another world. And the way they use black and white and color and everything is amazing. So I think, you know, that's not a movie I'll seek out to watch, but if it's on, it automatically brings that kind of magic back. So like, you know, what Hollywood did so well in the golden era, you know, Sound of Music is another one. And again, those are movies that used to be broadcast on television at Thanksgiving and Christmas. So those would be probably mine. And then my kind of, I'm trying to think. I could say my highbrow ones, like, you know, that's incomplicit as well. Like, are you going to say the art house kind of respectable, like I'm a serious cineast answer, The Wizard of Oz, right? So they're obviously, you know, auteurs that I respect a lot. I mean, I think David Lynch actually is great in terms of capturing. I mean, he does make a lot of films about Hollywood, like Mulholland Drive is incredible, but also capturing like the seedy underside and also still speaking to issues like sexual abuse and abuse of power quite well in his movies. So yeah, and then there's obviously foreign directors I can name to make myself sound you know, more erudite, a lot more free answer.
Is there one movie, Winnie, that people would be surprised to find that you really love?
Yeah, probably Braveheart.
Yeah, that is surprising.
Because I mean, I live in the UK, right? And so I had this obsession with Scotland growing up, and I still kind of marginally do. So, and again, for me, it was like being able to be transported to another world. So I grew up in suburban New Jersey, you know, my parents are immigrants, right? So it was not of the demographic mainstream there. And I think I always just wanted to travel or go somewhere, you know, very far from where I was. So I have since traveled quite a lot in my adult life and I live abroad, but for some reason I fixated on Scotland in my adolescence. And then I saw Braveheart and I'm like, oh my God, Scotland's this amazing place. Even though in Braveheart, it still is like medieval and muddy and the weather's terrible, right? But Braveheart does have that classic Hollywood arc of like the hero, right? With great cinematography and everything. And then it kind of meshed with my whole love for Scotland. So I think like now, especially as somebody that lives in the UK, I'll watch and be like, oh my God, that's so broad brushstroke in its portrayal of like heroes and villains and stuff. But at the same time, like it's rousing cinema, right?
Absolutely.
So anyway, Marjorie, I'll let you answer that question.
Oh, geez. Well, same with you. It's like an impossible almost question. But if, you know, if Casablanca is on, I will always sit down and watch it. And Wizard of Oz has been, I mean, I have Wizard of Oz Christmas ornaments. You know, I've loved the Wizard of Oz since I was 10 years old. So I would have to second you with that. I love a movie mostly for its mood and the look of it, although it's a very fine movie, I think, Road to Perdition.
Interesting.
Yeah, I really love that movie. I just think it's so tragic and so heartwarming at the same time, and so beautiful to look at, and well acted and written in the whole thing. And who doesn't love Paul Newman? The Verdict. I love The Verdict, just as with Paul Newman as the alcoholic lawyer. And it's not, you know, it's kind of a potboiler, but that's another one I'll always watch if it comes on. I love The Last Samurai, which is kind of a, I guess is, you know, sort of your brave heart. It's, but I just,
we're all those.
That I'll just watch anytime it's on. So those are some of, those are, what am I leaving out? Probably a lot of stuff, but those are some of my favorites.
Before we run out of time and we're rapidly approaching that point, can both of you, if you'd like, tell us a little bit about what's next for you as authors. We'll start with you, Marjorie.
Oh, okay. Well, I have just turned in my second Joey Jessup mystery. And it follows Joey onto another movie. She's dealing with the trauma that she experienced during Final Cut, but she wants to go back to work. So she's working on a movie that's set in the golden age of Hollywood. And it's called Starstruck.
Cool.
And of course, there are problems. There are problems on the movie, and including she gets involved with looking into the cause of a hit and run accident that's taken place very close to the movie location while they're shooting in downtown LA. And she finds that it may be linked to one of the movie stars.
I like you, but I also like the idea of the fact that there's going to be more books set in that world, seeing, you know, using kind of the intrigue of a Hollywood film production as the setting, but then also, you know, having a costume person as the main character, because that there is that glimpse and that understanding of the costume world in Hollywood, which was so interesting about your book. So glad that there's another
one
coming.
Thank you very much.
Yeah.
About you, Winnie, what's next for you?
So I'm writing a book, which actually you can get a teaser of it in the paperback edition of Complicit has a teaser of my next book in it, which I'm a bit kind of nervous about because it's the first time the public's going to read it. It's not going to come out until 2025, but it is about three adult siblings who are estranged and they're kind of forced to go on a road trip together across America to see their ailing mother in California. And they're Chinese American, and they've kind of grown in quite different ways, and so they're quite separated from each other ideologically, politically, and like financially as well. So they're kind of forced to do that because their mother basically says, I have an operation next month, and I haven't seen the three of you together in person in a while, so I want you to go, but I want you to go on a road trip and stop at the Grand Canyon on your way over to California. And so in their 40s are grumbling and they're like, come on, mom, like you're going to make us go on a road trip together. But the reason that the Grand Canyon comes up is because 30 years ago when they were kids, the whole family had tried to go on a road trip to see the Grand Canyon and they never got there for reasons that you find out during the course of the novel. So you kind of have that mystery of kind of back what happened in the past, but then at the same time, these siblings who haven't spoken in years in some ways are kind of forced to go on this road trip together and kind of hopefully bridge those distances that have grown up between them.
Well, that's a rich premise. That sounds fascinating.
Yeah, and I wrote 66 as that was my favorite. So basically I want to say like a year, almost like 2 years ago, a year and a half ago, I did that research. And so I flew to Chicago and I hired a car and, you know, drove to California on Route 66 to do the research. So it takes a long time. In my case, I'm like, it's not gonna be that long for the novel to come out, but how long it takes sometimes.
Before we conclude, is there ways that people tuning in can learn more about your books? Do you have social media platforms, websites?
Yeah, I am on all the platforms. I just started TikTok, so I only have one video right now. I might have two by the time this comes out. But I'm Winnie M. Lee at on Twitter and on Instagram, and I've got a Facebook page as well. So I kind of post about that. I don't know when this is coming up, when this is going live, but I'm doing a book tour in America in the Northeast from June 20th to the 29th. I'll have other events that are online events as well for people to tune into.
Right. And yes, I'm on Facebook and Twitter and Instagram. I'm not on TikTok. And I do have a website, marjoriemccown.com.
That's great. I can't believe how quickly our time has flown by. We've been very fortunate to have with us two entertaining and insightful authors, Winnie and Marjorie, whose new books, one in paperback, one in hardcover, are just out, Complicit and Final Cut. I'd like to thank both authors for taking time to visit us and share with us. And I'd like to thank everyone for tuning in to another recorded chat at the Boys and Pen Bookstore.
Hello. We hope you're enjoying our programs and podcasts with authors. We'd like to expand them, and your help would be appreciated. Please make a donation at poisonedpenfoundation.org. 100% of the proceeds will go to help connect authors with readers in this difficult time. Thank you.